Okay, while we're waiting for my presentation to load, and I notice that there's probably a drop in energy because we're coming down off of our big cookie sugar high, I want to ask everybody to just stand up for a minute. Come on, it won't hurt. Just right where you are, just stand up for a minute. Reach your hands up and try and grab onto those ceiling fixtures. All right, thank you very much. Now you can sit down. I want you to get your blood flowing, because you don't want to miss any of the important findings from our CDC-sponsored research this afternoon. And we did a lot of it. Instead of just presenting the research findings in a traditional format, although I'm doing some of that, I wanted to put this in the context of risk communication. Time does not allow me to go into a lot of detail, so I'm just assuming, since you're all here about vaccine safety, you all know about risk communication thinking. You know, this is Peter Sandman's model, where he says risk is a function of hazard and the actual hazard involved in the risk and the outrage that consumers have around that hazard. The interesting challenge, which is not all that different from all of vaccine communication right now, but was especially pertinent in H1N1 this year, is we've got really two challenges going on at once. And there are two different situations which, according to the risk communication format, demand different strategies. And CDC was trying very hard to modulate their strategy because they were aware of this. So on the one hand, you had the disease and the public perception of the disease, which actually has a hazard involved with it. People are getting sick. People are dying from it. But the people's concern about it went from June, where it was kind of low, to at best moderate at the height of the season. Despite what you may have seen in all the media coverage, I think we've got some information in here and some other information that people's like panic about the disease never got as serious as some things we worry about every day. So the goal in the communication about the disease was to get people excited or concerned about the disease, to move them from apathy to concern. While on the other hand, the vaccine, which I think everybody in this room and anybody who's looked at the data will say is a low hazard intervention. There are not many adverse events. But there was a lot of outrage over it, especially as the tension in the season got higher, that people were very concerned about the vaccine. So the goal there was 180 degrees different. It was to move people from concern to apathy about the disease, kind of like the old days with childhood vaccination, when the mother would just bring their baby in and they'd say, oh, here are all the shots they need to get, and they'd get about it, and they wouldn't even pay attention. And hopefully we can bring those in. But anyway, since you're all familiar with risk communication, I'm just going to zap right through this. These are some of the, Peter Sandman lays out about a dozen key components of outrage. And if you want to reduce people's outrage, you move it from, you change your, the thing they're outraged about, the risk from a voluntary, it decreases if it's voluntary versus coerced. Well, that's backwards. So it's converse backwards. Natural versus industrial, familiar versus exotic. So more exotic risks are concerned, have more outrage associated with dreaded versus not dreaded, familiar versus exotic. Oh, that's there twice. And whether the thing comes from a trustworthy source or an untrustworthy source. And in our research, a lot of these outrage components came out in the findings we had. Okay, so very quickly, the methodology was three rounds of focus groups and two waves of online surveys. We were exploring, because we knew things were changing very quickly, we wanted to explore the knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs about H1N1 influenza virus and the vaccine, and we wanted to get their stated whether they intended to get vaccinated or not, and we also looked at some communication materials. Research participants were all the ACIP priority groups. You can see them here. We have pregnant women, persons who provide care for infants, the ones who can't get vaccinated, children and young adults 6 months to 24 years old, and persons with medical conditions. So we had three rounds of research, 15 in June, 64 mini groups in August and September, and 24 mini groups in October. and you can see the locations there. And then we had two waves of online surveys for a total of about 1,300 participants in August and October. It was mostly closed-ended questions, and I'll get into some of the items later on. And then we tested some statements about the safety and monitoring. This was a critical thing for CDC to get their finger on the pulse of what people were thinking about the H1N1 vaccines. We had a lot of statements that we kept adjusting through the testing process, some VIS statements, some fact sheets, some patient education materials, and then some communication materials that we also tested. Okay, so our findings. Before I go through the findings, let me just remind you where we were last June. I know you're all painfully aware of how H1N1 went, but at that time, the first wave had waned. Media interest had definitely dropped about H1N1. There were stories. There were a lot of stories about school outbreaks, and there was a story circulating about the vaccine production and a possible fall wave. So here are some of the findings. This is about the H1N1 disease. And this was pretty amusing. We sometimes give the people a lot less credit than we ought to about how they see the link between the media and public perceptions. And they were all over the fact that, well, it's not in the news anymore, so we're not worried about it anymore. I mean, that came up over and over again. It was very clear that there was a connection, that news has fallen off, so we're not worried about it anymore. Nobody really was all that worried about it. Although there were some concerns. People reported personal protective behaviors widely, be it, you know, your hand washing, avoiding crowded situations. They were worried about public transportation. They talked about workplace interventions that were being discussed or implemented. So there was some concern about the disease. This continues with the disease. There was a lot of discussion about, well, why is it no longer called swine flu? And they could kind of see through what was going on there, and it affected the credibility of public health that all of a sudden they changed their names. Obviously, it was under pressure from the pork industry. There was a lot of confusion about why is this disease different from any other flu disease, and nobody really could figure that out. There were questions about the vaccine, but at this point, they weren't really that much about safety. It was more about how was it going to administer. Because remember, at that point, we were talking about, well, maybe there's going to be two shots, and who's going to get it? And, that's really inconvenient. And what if they only get one shot? And is the vaccine going to help you if you're already sick? And what if you get sick between your two doses? These are the kind of questions you're getting about the vaccine in June. Okay, so moving forward a couple of months, we're moving into August and September. The second wave is starting. It hasn't really fully hit yet. Media interest is definitely on the rise, and the seasonal vaccine was just coming into the market. And there was a lot of stories then about, well, when are we going to see this H1N1 vaccine? When are we going to be able to get it? So in this cut of the focus groups, there was a lot of talk about, well, you know, is this for real or is this just hype? You know, should we really be concerned about this? There was mixed awareness. People were very confused about the vaccine, about when it was going to be available, that there might be shortages. This didn't necessarily translate into, like, demand for the vaccine, but there was a lot of people were thinking about this a lot in August and September. There's still confusion about what the vaccine was supposed to do, if it was going to help you if you're already sick, and definitely this point became very important later on, which was the vaccine was new, it was novel, it was untested, it was rushed to market, a big risk communication problem. Then we go into October. October was the absolute top of media interest. It was like, I was in my hotel room and I changed the channels, and every channel, it's H1N1 24/7. We're at the peak of the second wave. There's widespread, the seasonal supply is getting sucked up, and the H1N1 vaccine is just about ready to get released, but it's not available yet. So at this time, we saw that there was a very high awareness and interest in the vaccine. We had more reports of people knowing people who actually had the disease, and that was a key determinant of whether people were interested in the vaccine. If they knew somebody in their neighborhood or even in their town that had the disease, they were much more concerned about it. There was a lot of awareness the virus is spreading among college students, but there was continued perception that the at-risk were young children, seniors, and I forgot to put it in here, persons with medical conditions. That was definitely a finding here, despite the other messages that have been put out there. This was interesting, that people did not personalize the risk of the disease. So there was a lot of discussion that, oh yes, this is a serious disease, but I'm not really concerned about it because it's not a problem for me, which really influenced the whether people were interested in the vaccine. And this chart here, which is a combination of the October and the August waves. So this one is perceived risk of serious complications of H1N1 influenza. You can see, despite, you know, this was when all the news stories were out there. Despite that, for almost all the groups, the plurality or majority of respondents to our survey perceive little or no risk to the disease. That's a big problem for us if we're going to get people interested in the vaccine. Interestingly, we had a good job of getting pregnant women concerned. You can see 68% of them saw there was a higher, somewhat high risk for them. You know, the medical conditions people, even them, which is surprising, they're almost split 50-50. So the vaccine concerns here get much more troubling here. The vaccine was rushed to market. The media attention, maybe a boost in tension to get, the media attention did a great job, you see here, between August and October in changing people's intention to get the seasonal vaccine. That's a statistically significant difference from 40 to 47%. But interestingly, for H1N1, it stayed flat, 35, 37%. So although the concern went up, the intention to get vaccinated stayed the same for H1N1. And you can see everybody, we used up all the seasonal shot. So CDC responded to this and developed some communication materials to try and drive home the personal risk. These three materials all did well with the sneezing young woman there, and you can see everybody can recognize that situation. Interestingly, the subway shot resonated great in places where there are no subways. Far Texas, which, you know, nobody down there has ever been on a subway, but they really looked at this and said, oh yeah, I ride the bus all the time, I'm really worried about that. And the risk condition one over here also did well. So back to vaccine concerns, this is in the third wave. There was a whole lot of confusion about, well, H1N1, the symptoms are exactly the same. You can't know whether you have H1N1 or you have seasonal, but you gotta have two vaccines. Nobody could figure that out. The way people define if influenza disease is by the symptoms. And if it's the same symptoms, it's got to be the same disease. And this created also a tension where we're trying to reassure people because the vaccine's exactly the same. So if it's exactly the same, why do I need a different vaccine? Confusion over the priority groups, the thimerosal, and you know, we had patient education materials that talked about thimerosal, and that got people all worried, especially parents. And there's a lot of concern if it had been adequately tested. Here's a couple of statements responding to some of these findings that CDC developed in order to make the new vaccine seem not like a new vaccine that's familiar by tying it to the seasonal vaccine, which has a good perception for safety in the American public, made by the same manufacturers, same procedures for both of them. So, In conclusion, I mean, this is no surprise, my first bullet point, vaccine communications become very complicated in the last 5 to 6 years. Now we have two challenges which have to be treated with different strategies. And sometimes the different approaches conflict with one another. And while you're trying to reassure them that the vaccine is safe because it's exactly the same, well, on the other hand, then they're not concerned about the disease. It's important to use the right tool for the job, so to know when you're trying to reassure people or when you're trying to dispel myths or where you're trying to build up the credibility of the speaker rather than just raise concern about the disease. And be mindful of the communication history of your disease and your vaccine and how your changes in strategies to respond can be confusing to the American public. And as the vaccine recommendations continue to change and expand, especially for flu, it gets very hard for the American public to keep up with. It requires a lot of effort on the part of us, the communicators, to explain to them why these changes have made and try and retain the same market share we have with in the public with acceptability for vaccination. I want to give thanks to Chris and Alan, our funders, and the co-authors from AED, and Michael's Opinions Research, who helped us with the research. Thank you.